Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not often one gets to say this, but Wall Street has seen the error of its subprime ways, in one regard anyway. The three big banks that had been working on a bailout fund gave up today. No sense, you know, throwing good money after bad. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. And by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Great to have you with us on this Friday, everybody. It is the 21st of December today. Just three short days ago, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and Bank of America swore their subprime rescue plan was still going to happen. It had come to be called a super sieve, or structured investment vehicle, essentially a way for Wall Street to put off the pain of dealing with some of the shaky investments it made. Problem was, nobody was willing to chip in the billions of dollars needed to backstop the off-the-books debt. Most banks have decided instead to rip that Band-Aid right off, and Citigroup is probably the best example. Last week, it took $49 billion of subprime-related debt and added it to its own books. You can look for an official announcement on the death of the super sieve, probably on Monday. Another way that Wall Street is trying to move past subprimes is by looking overseas. We have mentioned sovereign wealth funds a couple of times now. Morgan Stanley and Citigroup, there's that name again, have tapped sovereign funds for operating cash. Today's participant is Merrill Lynch. The bank is thinking about a $5 billion deal with Singapore. And it's not just Wall Street. The Swiss bank UBS has sold a slice of itself to Singapore as well. Also, apparently, to Saudi Arabia. Marketplace's Jill Barshay has more.
UBS shareholders in Europe are kicking up a big fuss about the Saudis. Todd Malin is the president of the Organization for International Investment. He says there's not much opposition to these foreign government investments in the U.S. He says Wall Street banks need the money. And besides, he says, these funds aren't buying the banks out completely.
They are getting different terms than you would be able to get just buying on the New York Stock Exchange. But on the other hand, they're not getting control. They're not getting a board seat.
Foreign funds are grabbing stakes for about the same price that an American vulture fund might get for rescuing a troubled company. Ryan Lentell is a banking analyst at Morningstar. He says when these big funds buy into the banks, the slices held by existing shareholders get smaller. UBS investors aren't too happy about that, he says, but they're happy to see their stock price stop falling.
I think the investor backlash that we've seen will be more about the losses. So I don't really see investor backlash from foreign capital flowing into the U.S. and European institutions.
Lentell says investors see a silver lining to these bailouts. They give the banks important allies in China and the Gulf states, and that could help these banks expand into some of the world's most profitable markets. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Here's a tale of two companies. They sell the same stuff. The actual stores even look kind of similar, but they couldn't be more financially different. Best Buy is going gangbusters. Profits have soared, sales are way up, and Circuit City can only wish. Shares there gave back 28% today. They're down 75% so far this year, and things are expected to get worse. We asked Stacey Vanek-Smith to find out how the two companies wound up in such different places.
Consumers have been tight with their money this holiday season, but industry analyst Paul Nolte says there is one thing people still seem willing to splurge on.
A lot of the electronics, the flat screen, a lot of the gaming and that type of stuff is really what's moving at this point in the marketplace.
That should mean the best of times for electronics retailers. It certainly has been for Best Buy. Strangely enough, though, it's been the worst of times for Circuit City. Investors dumped their shares today after the company reported flagging sales and losses that were even greater than expected. Industry consultant Bert Flickinger says it all comes down to customer service, and where Best Buy has invested in its website and the Geek Squad, Flickinger says Circuit City has taken a flawed less-is-more approach.
Circuit City seems to be following what might be a regrettable retail model to increase cash flow. One cuts costs, so cuts inventory, cuts staff. You can get away with it for a couple of years, but eventually the shopper sees the stores not up to the same standards.
And, says Flickinger, once those shoppers leave, it's very hard to get them back.
It costs $6 for every $1 of lost sales to try to get that consumer to come back, and even then your chance of success is only about 50%.
Circuit City has also lost several executives this year. Earlier this week, the company approved millions of dollars in cash incentives to keep the top managers who are still with the company. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Whatever their financial condition, retailers took heart from the latest batch of consumer spending figures that were out this morning. The Commerce Department reported personal spending jumped 1.1% last month. A big chunk of that was holiday-related, of course, but hey, you take it where you can get it, right? Traders were on that consumer spending number like green on beans. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Washington Mutual is this country's biggest savings and loan, and the loan part is where it's gotten itself into trouble. Last week, the company announced it would write down $1.6 billion worth of fourth-quarter subprime debt. It's cutting more than 3,000 jobs, and it's being investigated by the New York Attorney General, Andrew Cuomo. But wait, there's more. The Securities and Exchange Commission is looking into how Washington Mutual handled mortgages based on inflated home appraisals. Jeremy Hobson has more.
The Securities and Exchange Commission probe is just the beginning, says David Barenbaum of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He points to a recent study that found 90% of appraisers feel pressure from a mortgage broker or a lending institution to overvalue a home.
Appraisal inflation is the dirty little secret of the lending industry. And quite candidly, industry, whether it's a mortgage broker or others, profit from those higher values.
Terry Duncan, president of the Appraisal Institute, says that's because with a higher appraisal, the broker, the lender, and the real estate agent walk away from a home sale with fatter commissions and fees.
But the one that's left holding the bag is the property owner because they have a property that's not worth what they thought it was worth.
Barenbaum says all this is just adding to the nation's housing woes.
Yes, the market is depreciated, but many people paid too much to begin with.
Washington Mutual wouldn't comment. It did issue a statement denying any effort to inflate home appraisals. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Financial shenanigans, as you know, have been a theme this year. Author Robert Kuttner says lawmakers on both sides of the aisle need to answer for the latest hiccup in the U.S. economy. His new book is called The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Bob Kuttner, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Is it ever possible in prosperous times or otherwise to separate politics from economics and vice versa?
No, never. Because the rules of economics are set by politics. And you can have a laissez-faire economy or you can have a more managed economy. And those decisions, of course, have to be political decisions.
What are we to do then in times like these where the economy is shaky at best, if not exactly not prosperous?
Well, we have to rally the people who used to be the constituents for a more managed, more mixed form of capitalism and get the system back on track. The subprime meltdown is the poster child for the failure of the idea that markets could regulate themselves because we've had a pretty vivid demonstration of the fact that they can't.
Explain for me how you would apply this managed capitalism in a world that, you know, sort of to quote yourself back at you, I mean, where politics and economics are so completely intertwined.
Well, let me give you an example, of course, and that's subprime. This was a calamity that didn't have to happen. There was actually regulation passed by Congress that actually directed the Federal Reserve to issue standards for mortgage lending. And Alan Greenspan, because he believed that markets regulate themselves, did not deign to issue regulations. So 13 years later, the result is subprime. And in researching the squandering of America, I went back and did a lot of reading about the kinds of scams that went on in the 1920s. And they were very complicated, but they all boiled down to three abuses: lack of transparency, too much leverage, and insider conflicts of interest. And supposedly, the regulations that were put in place in the 30s got rid of that. But if you think about Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossing and the conflicts of interest on the part of accountants and the kind of things that led up to subprime, it's the same three problems.
Yeah, I guess my point, though, would be that, you know, these things, these cycles in the economy and in the markets and businesses take decades to play out. And so what we'll have here in the next 18 months or 2 years is a whole raft of really restrictive regulations as to who can or cannot do what. Is that your idea of managed capitalism, more restrictive regulation?
How about protective?
All right.
How about transparent? I mean, it's very interesting how this all gets characterized. Seems to me that if you want a public policy of helping moderate-income people become homeowners, you don't send them down the street to the local mafia lender. You have a policy of having mortgages that are subsidized for the first few years. You get a below-market interest rate. You get your foot in the door, and you have a shot at living the American dream. The kind of predatory lending that was done by subprime lenders was exactly the opposite. You take people who can barely afford to make mortgage payments, and you do a bait and switch on them, and then you charge them over the life of the loan 2 or 3 points higher than the typical mortgage borrower gets. And that's the kind of thing that, of course, ought to be restricted. It's bad mortgage practice. It's bad public policy. We're seeing the damage that results when you don't restrict this kind of predatory practice.
Bob Kuttner is a founder and the co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. His latest book is called The Squandering of America: How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Bob Kuttner, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Whatever weakness the economy is showing, one thin slice of it is doing just fine. Luxury goods continue to sell on both the consumer and corporate levels. Godiva Chocolates was sold off last night for $850 million. Maybe the new owner can come up with a line of mints for hotel pillows, because the top-end hotel market is booming too, with plush one-upmanship. Alex Goldmark looked into reports of 6 and even 7-star hotels.
Type best hotel in the world into Google and you find links describing the Burj Al Arab in Dubai. It's got a Rolls-Royce chauffeur service and nightly pyrotechnics on a man-made private island. It's also got a 7-star rating, according to some reports.
If your knob goes to 10, people want to say they turned it to 11.
That's Brian Gilbrandt, head of operations at Ritz-Carlton and Spinal Tap enthusiast. 24 of his company's hotels get the traditional 5 stars. He says many of his younger rivals, like the Burj Al Arab, like to claim they're a cut above.
I think it's healthy. We certainly welcome the competition, and it continues to push everybody forward and up.
It's pushing Gilbrandt's to recruit celebrity chefs to open restaurants on site. And the 5-star Moscow Ritz boasts free caviar and a vodka sommelier. Gilbrandt says consumers' expectations of luxury are changing.
It's not about going to the white tablecloth restaurant with the waiter in the tuxedo and the white glove. More often now, we see customers that want to relax and enjoy luxury on their terms, not the industry's terms.
So new hotels from Miami to Shanghai are doing their best to anticipate customers' whims. They're offering amenities that didn't even exist before, like surround sound iPod stations and a technology butler to help you use them. Shane O'Flaherty of Mobile Travel Guide says hotels want credit for these kinds of innovations, and they often give themselves an extra star for providing them.
We call them self-ratings, meaning that a hotel just calls themselves, like, I'm a 6-star or I'm a 7-star.
Mobile Travel Guide invented the star rating system for the U.S. back in 1958. Michelin and AAA also rate hotels on a 5-star or 5-diamond scale.
Of the 8,000 hotels that we rate on an annualized basis, there's only 37 5-star hotels, and there's only 117 4-star hotels.
To get the top rating, a hotel needs to score 90% on a checklist of 750 different criteria, like staff speak clearly without using slang and call guests by their names. Cleanliness and decor count too. No hotel has ever gotten a perfect score.
6-stars and 7-stars, what's out in the marketplace, are really just hype for the consumer.
What, no credit for a cabana butler to wipe my sunglasses?
The person who puts lotion on butler.
Even better.
You know, those are nice things to have at a property, yet, you know, for us, it's all about, you know, how the consumer feels.
Some of the new luxury travelers really do feel better with a gold-framed television, 13 different pillow options, and a bathroom the size of a Cadillac. But both O'Flaherty and the Ritz's Gilbrants agree. What five-star customers really want is personal attention.
It's really giving the customer what they want, how they want it, before they even know they want it.
I want some of that. In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
Well, David Johnson, I don't know what you did to deserve today, but you must be living right.
You're darn right. Who's popular now, huh?
That's right.
Whose calls are getting returned now, huh? It'll last a day or so. Well, you know, today is the third Friday of the month, and I know you felt that special something all day long. And it's the third Friday of the month. It's the end of the quarter, and it's the options, the indexes, the futures, and it's quadruple witching day.
Yeah. Does that really mean anything, though?
Well, not as much as it used to. Yeah. Except that, you know, did you see the volume today? 2,300,000,000
shares.
Yep. And here's the bad thing, just as an I told you so, is usually we reverse whatever we did on quadruple witching day, we reverse the following Monday. So I guess in theory we ought to go down 205 points. But, you know, there's something good about it. You got a good feeling about today. And
why?
Really a good feeling about, well, because they don't paint them all with the same brush. And that's what I hate.
What does that mean, they don't paint them all with the same brush?
Well, okay, you know the distinction between a stock market and a market of stocks?
No, but I'm sure you'll tell me. Go ahead.
There, you just sit down here. Right. I just happen to have a couple of minutes. No, in a stock market, everything moves in one direction. You can pick up a dart and throw it at the paper and buy something and it'll go up. Okay.
Yeah.
But in a market of stocks, its picking is very important, and you pick the right stocks and you'll make some money. For example, Circuit City, bad. Mm-hmm. Best Buy, good. Uh-huh. Darden Restaurants, bad. McDonald's, good. Research in Motion, you know, the BlackBerry people?
Yeah.
Good. Palm, bad. Goldman Sachs, good. Everybody else, bad.
Yeah. All right, so earn your paycheck and draw me the larger lesson here.
Well, the lesson is that we have not quite gotten rid of all of the bad stuff out there, but the money's staying in the market. They're going around looking for, you know, for good investments. The money's coming out of uncertainty, you know, housing and financial or whatever else. And it's going into the new safe havens. You know what the new safe havens are?
No.
Research in Motion, Google, Apple.
I should have been listening.
You know why? You know why it's going into Garmin or Research in Motion? Because you never found a subprime woe in a company that makes GPS systems.
Yeah.
And those people don't even know what a sieve is. In fact, I was so glad to hear you do that story up at the top about this super sieve, this structured investment vehicle thing. They're not going to do it. You know why? Because I'm so old, I don't have a lot of like hard disk space. And in order to figure out what that was, I was going to have to forget something probably very important. And now I'm glad I just never even figured out what the heck it was to begin with.
Which is scary, because that's why we call you, to figure out all this stuff.
Well, but the important stuff. I'm telling you, there's so much chaff, you'll never miss it.
All right. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. I will be gone next week. Enjoy yourself. I will be working
because it's a very important time of the market. I'll be taking losses and gains and opening KIOs and
all that good stockbroker stuff. David Johnson down in Dallas. Thank you, David.
Good to be with you.
See you in a couple of weeks. Coming up, taking the wow out of Wall Street's holiday parties.
You know, the space is lovely and the DJ will still provide great music, but it won't be the same, oh my God, when you walk in.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials jumped 205 points today, 1.5% to end at 13,450. The Nasdaq climbed 51 points, nearly 2% to finish at 2691. The S&P 500 put on 24 points, 1.67%, closed at 1484. For the week that was, the Dow gained 0.8%. The NASDAQ chugged up 2.1%. The S&P 500 rose 1.1%. Retail shares rode the personal spending wave. Thank you very much. Macy's gained 1.8%. Nordstrom rose 3.5%. Home Depot nailed a 1.5% increase. Energy shares advanced on a hunch the economy will stay on an upswing and that oil prices thus will as well. Schlumberger gushed up 4.25%. Exxon pumped out a 1.4% gain. U.S. Steel forged ahead 6%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note climbed to 4.18%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. The New York Stock Exchange closes early. Trading wraps up at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Brunette screen siren Ava Gardner was born on December 24, 1922. The Ava Gardner Museum stands in Smithfield, North Carolina, the town where she is buried. And children around the world bait Santa Claus with cookies and milk placed in front of the fireplace. It's the night before Christmas. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Before the perfect pie crust in the signature series at Kmart, before the minimum security federal prison, there was Entertaining, Martha Stewart's first book. It was 25 years ago this month that she first shared her secrets with us. Commentator Peter Hyman thinks the lifestyle queen's best design is herself.
As we commemorate a quarter century of Miss Stewart's reign as the doyenne of domestic culture, it seems appropriate to ask, what has Martha wrought? The obvious answer? A nation where even NASCAR-loving tough guys understand why Celadon is the best color for a powder room, to say nothing of the importance of the Garden Fresh crudité platter. And while public impressions of her range from antidote to first-wave feminism to ruthless tyrant who recently did time in a federal prison, these character assessments miss the larger point. Martha Stewart has always existed more as an aspirational ideal than an actual person. Like Ralph Lauren, Stewart's gift is the ability to boil down WASP conventions into mass-market consumer items. She didn't invent the Hamptons summer home, but she did perfect a means of translating its components into magazine spreads and product lines for Kmart. Though her single-minded obsession with creating a lifestyle brand is evidence of a certain type of business chops, there's something desperate about her need to continually celebrate herself via every media channel known to humankind. After 25 years, she's such a part of the cultural fabric that her omnipresence seems almost natural, until you consider just how calculated this interweaving has been. Now, this is not to say that her desire to help others beautify their worlds is inauthentic or that she hasn't worked hard for her nine-figure net worth. It simply means that for all of the advice she provides to others about crafting the perfect life, Martha Stewart's finest creation is her own persona. She was, after all, raised by middle-class Polish immigrants, not Connecticut Yankees, though you wouldn't know it by looking at her empire. What she has wrought, ultimately, is the uniquely American idea that mining a culture you weren't born into for purposes of self-invention is fine. Actually, more than fine. It's almost a tenet of our national religion, especially if that culture excels at garden parties.
Peter Hyman is a writer living in Brooklyn. His first book is called The Reluctant Metrosexual. Write us when you get a chance. Our website is marketplace.org. Maybe you noticed your company holiday party this year wasn't quite as grand, more shrimp cocktails and beer than champagne and caviar. A consulting firm in Manhattan estimates the number of companies even throwing a bash at all this year is down almost 10%. You can chalk it up to worries about the economy. And Marketplace's Amy Scott tells us one industry in particular is feeling the pinch.
Wall Street knows how to throw a party, like the kind of holiday gala event planner Jennifer Gilbert put together for an investment bank last year.
We would literally transform the space. Literally, like bring in our own walls, re-carpet, bring in lounge chair furniture, bring in fountains. I had greeters outside. I'd have models walking around.
Yes, models.
We'd have 3 different sets of entertainment. We would do a gift when they left. It would just feel lavish.
This year, Gilbert says that same client is skipping the $80,000 decor. There's a DJ, no limo service home, and oh yeah, no gift.
You know, the space is lovely, and the DJ will still provide great music, but it won't be the same, oh my God, when you walk in.
As subprime mortgage losses continue to mount, Wall Street firms have slashed their party budgets. Earnings are down at most of the big banks. Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns just reported their first ever quarterly losses. Gilbert says it's the worst party season she's seen since just after 9/11. At T-Bar Steak and Lounge on the Upper East Side, owner and caterer Arthur Bacall is a bit more upbeat. He says instead of renting out the ballroom at the ultra-posh Mandarin Oriental, firms might book a restaurant like his. He's already done 2 Wall Street parties here this year, and he's getting more requests for January, when you can get more for your money.
You know, where they might have had a large-scale, you know, orchestra or band along with a DJ, they might be either going with one or the other instead of both. But I got to tell you, the business, even though people want to think it's not doing as well, it's been a very busy season still.
And if the parties are a little less over the top these days, there may be another reason. After a number of scandals, the SEC is weighing a new rule that would require firms to track how much they spend entertaining clients and set limits. Chris Myers heads the compliance practice at law firm Holland & Knight. He says some firms are already bracing for tougher scrutiny.
I think they should be nervous about it because this is a growing trend across industry lines. And we're going to see more and more restrictions that are mandated as opposed to recommended.
The rule is also expected to throw water on an old staple of Wall Street entertainment, the strip club. Oh, brokers might still treat their clients to the occasional lap dance, but not on the company dime. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note to end the week, you've been hearing about sovereign wealth funds a lot. So has Saudi Arabia. As we alluded to up at the top of the program, the Saudis want to get in the game, and in a big way. According to the Financial Times today, the Saudis are going to create a fund that could be worth more than $900 billion. That would make it the largest sovereign fund in the world by a long shot. On a not completely coincidental note, crude gained 2.25 today to settle at $93.31 a barrel in New York City. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday before Christmas. Today, the Dow jumped 205 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ rose 51 points, nearly 2%. The S&P 500 bumped up 24 points, 1.75% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, Zimbabwe's lost children in South Africa.
When I came into South Africa, I was thinking that I'm going to find some jobs and work for my family, for my father, but I didn't find work.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.